Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 12:57, and that is Pacific Summer Time, and today being Friday, it's the big picture long-term audio for the various different asset classes. And just a quick review of what's been happening this week. The majority of markets have been in positive territory, but the big news story is that Wall Street broke out this week, and is about 1% above its all-time high on the S&P and on the Dow Jones. So despite the fact that the market is relatively unchanged in here today, this is an impressive move. It's also an indication that this lengthy congestion area that's been in evidence for much of the last 18 months is now over, and that we're getting a resumption of what has, and I think it is still very much correct to characterize this bull market as liquidity fueled. That has been the case for the last 7 years, and nothing has happened to question that conclusion. And I thought it was useful. Just before I started recording the audio, I went to the International Equity Library, and there's a section there for central bank base rates. And then when you look at those charts, it's really quite instructive because, for example, Indonesia has had its base rate, it's been coming down for the last year. It was at about 7.8, and right now it's at 6.5. So you're getting a contraction there. But and of course, much of the developed markets, particularly the OECD countries, with the exception of Australia and New Zealand, have got interest rates that are in the order of about 0.5% and below that. But where we're starting to see, and this is something that is perhaps worth highlighting from the medium-term perspective, is Brazil, where the short-term interest rate is 14.25%, and that has gone from the low back in around 2013 of about just above 7 to over 14. So the base rate has doubled in Brazil, and for an overnight deposit, that's really quite impressive. When you look around the world and see no yield at all, then places like Latin America, where there is maybe even the glimmer of of possible governance improving, then that is part of the reason that the Brazilian market has been outperforming this year, is because of the yields that are available, both in terms of owning the currency and then owning the stock market in a scenario where commodities represent one of the only undervalued assets out there, and therefore have catch-up potential. But it's perhaps worth considering that the rest of the world, if you look at, just very quickly, just click through that section of deposit rates, then it is only in Latin America where you've seen interest rates going up, that everywhere else we're at 0.5% or zero. So even though the Fed was the only one of the major central banks to raise interest rates, and that was at the end of last year, it is looking increasingly unlikely that they're going to raise rates this year, despite the fact that earlier on this year they had said that, and perhaps were being a bit overambitious by saying that they could raise rates 4 times. But if you look everywhere else, it is a pretty similar story, that it is central banks, by and large, cutting interest rates. Now, what does Latin America have in common? Why is it that is Latin America that's raising interest rates? Where you have Mexico, and their interest rate has gone from about 3 to 4.25 over the last year. Brazil has been so aggressive. Colombia has been aggressive, and of course the reason for that is because they're having economic problems, not least because commodity prices have been so weak. But commodity prices have at least found near term support, potentially medium term support. And if we look at the continuous commodity index, which we continue to believe is the benchmark, then that represents an unweighted index. So it gives us a good idea of what is happening in the commodity sector, rather than the CRB index, which is very heavily skewed towards energy. And it is really worth looking at the continuous commodity index, because that has broken a medium-term downtrend. It is now posting new recovery highs. We have seen substantial rallies in soft commodities like sugar, coffee, orange juice, cotton. Then we've had a significant rebound in gold, in silver, platinum, palladium, and indeed in the oil price, where oil prices have just about, although not quite, doubled from their low this year. And I continue to think that it's going to be more difficult for oil prices to rally, considering that prices did double, that the market is back in a relative balance, that obviously higher prices make marginal producers, or take some of the pressure off of marginal producers, and then there is the fact that they probably haven't had the Saudi Arabians, who have largely engineered both the collapse, particularly the collapse in oil prices, they probably haven't seen as many bankruptcies as they would like just yet. So they're not about to stop pumping at record volumes. But when we then go and look around, the continuous commodity index tells us that commodities are not only rallying in here and in a position of outperformance, but that they have also, they're among the only asset classes that are not making new all-time highs. So the potential for a continued catch-up move is perhaps the base case in this stage. Now, against that background, when you have countries that have got interest rates in the order of 7%, 14%, 10%, and everywhere else has got 0% or half of 1%, then what do international investors need in order to start supporting those markets? Then it's got to be that their currencies stop going down. But we've seen that. In fact, we've seen that not just in Latin America, but also in the ASEAN region, that the dollar had trended higher against those commodity-related emerging market currencies and ASEAN currencies for much of the last 4 years. And then they found support in not all at the same time, but certainly beginning from last October. That was with Indonesia, when the central bank intervened directly to support the market. But then we've seen support starting to come in for the Philippine peso, for the Taiwan dollar, for the Brazilian real, for the Mexican peso has been among the weaker currencies. But even there, there is potential that things might start to stabilize. Well, if you have their currencies beginning to stabilize, then all of the competitive advantage that a country gains from a 50% decline in their currency over a number of years, then they start to become realizable, that people can see that the path to a recovery is beginning to be clarified when the currency stops being devalued. And we're starting to see that in Latin America. So then when people start to look around and look at the world in general and see that we are moving into a position where the Fed is unlikely to raise interest rates and may even be forced to cut them, where the Bank of Japan, the Bank of England, the European Central Bank are all going to be pumping liquidity with absolutely no holds barred, then the potential for the liquidity fueled rally that let's put it a different way, that the fuel for the rally in the form of liquidity is about to get turned back on. And we've seen that there has been a correlation between the size of the Fed's balance sheet and the performance of the stock market for much of the last 7 years. So then with the potential for liquidity to get pumped back into the system, there is the potential for asset prices to inflate further. And then this is going to raise an existential question for value investors, for the very simple reason that they can look at the price earnings ratio and see that it is rising. they can look at the dividend yield and see that it is compressing. They can look at price to book and see that, or the enterprise value of their holdings, and they'll see that they're getting to be expensive. And they will lament that there is any real value opportunity out there, and yet prices continue to move higher, and therefore they are under significant pressure to have a position. And interesting that was one of the things that I believe Warren Buffett was discussing at the annual shareholder meeting just a few months ago, and it was to the way that I think he was describing it was that with interest rates where they are, then it is possible to justify a higher valuation on the basis of where we are in the cycle. And you know, that is the rationale, because the people managing companies are coming out of MBA schools, and the way that they are being taught is when interest rates are this low, you borrow, you buy back your shares. It doesn't matter what the price of the share is. You buy back those shares for the simple reason that equity costs more than debt, and debt is cheap. So therefore, you take out more debt, you take in the equity. And when debt is expensive, then you issue equity. Well, that is the rationale for the buybacks. Buybacks are at historic highs. Buybacks are perhaps not rising at the same level rate that they had been rising previously, but they're still at record levels, and that acts as at least a support for the market. And additional liquidity being pumped in acts as additional fuel to push prices higher. A clear downward dynamic would be required on both the Dow and the S&P to signal that they're a failed downside break. It would need to come down in a more dynamic fashion than it broke out to signal a failed upside break, and it would need to sustain a move below the 200-day moving average to really confirm a failed upside break in this kind of environment. If commodity prices continue to rally, and this is not unusual, this is something that we see in the latter stages of the majority of major bull markets, and there's a pretty simple rationale for it, that commodities would have come down because of the usually it's because supply has increased during the last bull market. Then prices don't recover because the recovery has, the economic recovery hasn't been as firm as anticipated. Then you need to see some bankruptcies and rationalization to withdraw some of the supply from the market. Then those shares start to respond to the potential for synchronized economic expansion as the pace of economic expansion improves. Well, in this case, we're perhaps not getting the synchronized economic expansion, but rather we're getting the synchronized monetary expansion and potentially even fiscal expansion. And then commodities start to price in a more buoyant environment overall. And because they're rallying off such depressed levels, then in percentage terms, it's a lot easier to go from 1 to 2 than it is from 20 to 40. So then they can stage very impressive rallies. And that's part of the reason that gold shares are up 100% this year already. But it's because they're coming off such remarkably depressed levels. And to put that into perspective, that gold shares were back at levels relative to gold that we haven't seen in nearly 20 years. They had squeezed every bit of fat out of those gold mines, there has been massive rationalization. And for the first time in more than a decade, gold shares are now offering positive leverage to the gold price. In fact, there wasn't any real need to own gold mines in the last bull market, because they were consuming so much of their free cash flow in expansion plans that they weren't able to pay dividends. And then you had the evolution of the ETF market, which really siphoned off a lot of available capital for the gold mining sector. Well, this time around, they are offering upside leverage to the gold price, and therefore they are much more attractive on this occasion than they were last time. And of course, you know, just for the supreme irony is that now, because you have ETFs, that they generally tend to be the first destination, because they were the best destination the last time around. But it's probably gold shares would probably be the best destination this time around. And gold prices are off their recovery peak, and rather comforting that they're coming down in a very orderly fashion. Gold prices were down about $5 today. Certainly not a downward dynamic. And I think that the largest reaction that we've had has been on an intraday basis has been about $20, which for a $1,300 security is really not a very large move. It continues to look like we're getting just a pause in consolidation and a little bit of an unwinding of the short-term overbought condition before prices can move higher from here. Now, if we are indeed moving into an additional phase of monetary and fiscal expansion, then there are going to be three different ways that that people will benefit from that. And it really is dusting off the playbook from the period after 2011. Because if you remember back then, we had also been through flash crashes. There was the May 6th flash crash. I think that was in 2010. We had been through significant bouts of volatility. There were some very large questions being asked about whether this rally could persist. And at the same time that QE2 had ended and the Fed was already talking about beginning to raise interest rates, when the economy just did not begin to fire on all cylinders, and they got the message pretty loud and clear from the financial sector that that investors did not believe the economy was ready for higher interest rates. And that doesn't sound particularly different from what we've seen just recently, that we have had these flash crashes where volatility spiked, where some of the automated trading systems have caused significant disruptions, where we have seen herding activity within those automated trading systems. And I personally find that I'm rather bemused that with such incredible growth in passive strategies, and then the automation of those passive strategies, that can only increase herding because whenever one and you can create an automated trading system with any buying and selling rules that one might want, but there's really only one way that you can size those positions, and that is to do with volatility. Because when you have a large number of positions, then the only way that you can manage the volatility or the beta of that portfolio would be to use the volatility as your position sizing mechanism. So when volatility spikes, they absolutely have to really sell part of their position in order to remain within their risk parameters, because that's the only way that they can function. And if progressively larger amounts of money are allocated in that fashion, then they'll all come to the same conclusion at the same time. And it means that we are going to have these occasional bouts of extraordinary volatility, and particularly on an intraday basis. And that's likely to remain the case for the foreseeable future. But it is most likely to occur during periods where you have indecision in the market, which is what we would consider a range to be. A range is a decision-making process where supply and demand come back into relative balance, and then that is when you are most likely to have those kinds of extreme pullbacks. Now, if the market has just broken out, then the decision-making process is over. That the center of gravity for the market coalesces around the demand side of the argument, and then prices can go higher from there. So then the likelihood of significant drawdowns on an intraday basis, like flash crashes, goes down. if we are indeed now moving into a similar situation that following 2011, we moved into a particularly consistent advance, because people really got the message that we were going to be supplied with ample liquidity, that there was going to be very low interest rates, massive availability of liquidity and capital, and then there was a competition to invest in either assets that offer a competitive yield, those that have the potential for capital appreciation, or those that have the potential for capital and currency and yield appreciation. Well, the ones that have got the potential for yield are going to be corporate bonds. Then they're also going to be dividend aristocrat type companies, or utilities or telecoms, kinds of companies that have either got very steady cash flows, or as a function of providing a service to a captured market, or it's going to be those types of companies that offer exposure to the global consumer or to the global economy, that will benefit from the provision of liquidity, not just in one jurisdiction, but globally. And dividend aristocrats and the autonomies certainly fall into that category. Then you're going to potentially have the emerging markets, where you have higher interest rates, the potential for capital appreciation in the stock market, and yield appreciation in both the currency and in the stocks. So then you could get emerging markets turning to positions of considerable outperformance, and that was certainly the case off the low in 2008. That was not so much the case in 2011, because they were already so high. But they have now been through a lengthy process where currencies have been under a great deal of stress. And not least because some of these countries have been under pressure because their major trading partners have been devaluing their respective currencies. And that has forced them to try and defend their currencies, following, in some cases, 50% and greater declines. And particularly for a place like Brazil, where governance has, failings in governance have been exposed by the collapse in commodity prices. And nonetheless, the Olympics is going to be starting up in Rio in the not too distant future. They're going to have, and that is going to be really quite a party, regardless of where the currency is. But it's one of the reasons that any country wants to have the Olympics is a PR exercise. So they're going to try their best to put a brave face on exactly what's happening in the country. But with the potential for commodities to continue to outperform and to continue to rally from depressed levels, and then the potential that those currencies have bottomed, and I think it is looking increasingly likely that we've seen medium-term lows in the majority of those Latin American countries. I suppose it is worth highlighting some of the improvements in governance that you've had in Latin America, where Macri has really started out on in Argentina, delivering on some of his election promises, and is doing as best as anyone might expect in trying to correct some of the major imbalances that are in that economy. That the Colombians have signed a peace deal with their with the drug lords, and that is also positive there. And the Colombian peso also bottomed last year. We can't say the same that we've had an improvement in governance in Venezuela, and that perhaps represents the biggest threat to the region because it is such a large bond market. But when we look around, generally speaking, in Brazil, the impeachment of Rousseff has probably been the benefits from it are beginning to be accrued in the stock market, but the fact that the vast majority of elected officials are equally corrupt is perhaps not great news. And what they really do need is probably a new election to clear out some of the dead wood in there. But that isn't stopping the stock market from rallying and responding to the continued firm tone on oil prices. When we then take a look further and look at Asia, Asia represents the large population center of the world where governance really is improving in some of the largest population countries. I think it is really an argument to say that that governance is still improving in China, with the increasingly belligerent tone that China is engaging with its neighbors in the South China Sea, and the potential that that is nothing more than an attempt for the administration there to deflect attention from the domestic economy. What we can probably conclude also is that the last thing they want is a crash. The last thing they want is to stoke fear, and therefore there is evidence that they're defending that 3,000 level on the CSI 300, which is the index that has futures, and that if and considering that the price of the index is less than 10% away from that level, then the risk of potential downside relative to potential for the market to just range higher and eventually gain more adherence so that it can stage a more powerful breakout does look more likely than not. If the Fed is not going to raise interest rates, that's pretty good news for the Hong Kong market. And certainly the price of property there is sky high, literally, considering the height of the towers. But it's also worth looking at the stock market, where you have the lowest valuations in the world, just about, and one of the more competitive yields for a highly liquid market, probably a better way of describing it. In India, there's probably no country benefits more from reasonably low oil prices, and India is benefiting enormously from its technological edge and the fact that it's the largest English-speaking country in the world. News this week that Google is investing so that it can educate 2 million programmers in India. It tells us that where they see the majority of the programming talent coming from, and that's phenomenally bullish for India over the medium term. Obviously, the country has significant challenges, and not least in developing infrastructure and an export sector to help employ the legions of young people that the population is providing. But India already has a significant educated workforce capable of competing on the global economy, and that really is its strength, where it hasn't its infrastructure and manufacturing sector where it really needs to improve, and a point that has been made often both here and elsewhere is that what India has, China needs, and what China needs, India has. So they represent two very different paths to development, and it really does hinge on whether governance is improving in order for that to continue. And governance in Europe is lagging badly, and the decision by the UK to leave the EU really throws the governance deficit that the Eurozone has into really quite sharp focus. And despite the fact that there are lofty ambitions and where European countries can hold hands and sing Kumbaya and not worry about the fact that you have one monetary policy for 27 fiscal policies, that contradiction is rapidly unwinding. And just like anything else, once you can identify what the contradiction is, then you know what the problem is going to be that's eventually going to bring it down. And that was an inherent contradiction in the Eurozone market since its inception. And it has taken considerably longer than anyone anticipated for it to really come to light. And we are going to see in the not, perhaps not too distant future, how all of that is going to play out with Italy. Because having forced the citizens of Cyprus to lose their savings in their banks before they could be bailed out, and using the fact that there were a number of Russian depositors with accounts in Cyprus as an excuse. It's going to be interesting how they treat a larger country like Italy, where there are masses of junior bonds that are non-performing and but have been sold to retail clients, and are they going to force those retail clients to lose their principal or a significant proportion of it in a potential default? And the EU has got a long history of looking the other way when a larger country wants to do something that it's really not supposed to, and we're perhaps getting towards a situation politically where that is becoming increasingly untenable because of the rise of populism. So there is every reason to expect that regardless of how the Italian situation is resolved, or more likely kicked down the road for someone else to make a big decision about in the next few years, then it's only a matter of time before the politics change, and that things come to a head where either the Eurozone breaks up or they vote for considerably more cohesion and solve that contradiction once and for all. That suggests that companies that have got a domestic Eurozone market focus are likely to remain volatile, whereas the major export sectors, particularly in an environment where the emerging markets are doing better and the developed markets are pumping both monetarily and fiscally, then we can even see an additional rally in the Eurozone, but it will be led by those export markets. And that suggests that we've been through a very difficult phase, and things could get easier to make money in the markets, provided the breakout on Wall Street is sustained. We have to look at it in the context of where we are in the cycle, and interest rates really are very low, and they represent a phenomenal bonds represent a phenomenal momentum move. You're certainly not buying them for yield, you're buying them for the momentum. And we're seeing an unwinding now of the short-term overbought condition on those bond futures. But it's hard to imagine that we're going to get a significant rally in yields when we have monetary and fiscal stimulus coming down the pipe in front of us. Then the momentum in the bond markets can continue, and the imbalances that we see in these markets will continue. The perhaps and longer term, we can define the beginning of the third psychological perception stage, and I should say the third and final psychological perception stage of a bull market, as when people really do believe that it is no longer worth their while to concentrate on fundamentals, but rather that they have to, not because they want to, not because they see value in it, but because they feel compelled to simply monitor the liquidity situation that is being provided for them by the market, and rather look at that as their primary arbiter for whether to be invested or not, rather than looking at the fundamentals of a market, because that's when fundamentals go out the window, and then you can have the valuations going from reasonable to somewhat expensive to downright expensive and incontrovertibly expensive, and yet people aren't looking at them because they are more concerned with what is going on in terms of the liquidity situation. So that's what euphoria represents in terms of the stock market. And it is looking increasingly likely that that is the kind of situation that we're moving into, that we've often characterized central banks as serial bubble blowers. And nothing at all has happened to question that conclusion. And therefore, they're not going to raise interest rates. They are not going to withdraw the liquidity until a bubble is unavoidable and absolutely in evidence. And then, you know, subsequent to that, you get a crash. But then we could be looking at a couple of years from now before any of that happens. And one of the things to really keep an eye on is the yield curve spread. That's the spread between the 2-year and the 10-year. And it has been contracting rather rapidly over the last while. Now, it is not yet at zero. So, therefore, what we are looking for is for when it goes to inverted territory, which would be below zero. If indeed that does happen, then we'll have a lead time of upwards of a year, and maybe somewhat more than that, before we get a recession taking hold in the USA. Generally speaking, that ratio has contracted from about 250 basis points to about 85 basis points in here today. And so it's still a way away from that zero level, but that's already a substantial contraction and flattening of the yield curve. So that is something that would be an indication of when we might expect the next recession. It would be hard to imagine that we're going to get a recession without it becoming inverted. And that suggests then that provided these breakouts are sustained, that we could be moving into a more consistent advance again, and where valuations really do get overbought. And of course, the best thing to do is to be long, but to retain money control discipline, to remain cognizant of the fact that we are in the third psychological perception stage, so it will not last forever, but that to enjoy it while it lasts and to exit when what could be a very consistent advance becomes inconsistent. And I think with that, I will leave you for today, and I wish all the best to all of you.